You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of February 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, from unrest in the CAR, anti-gay laws in Uganda and South African politics, James Schneider and Martin Plaut will join me to run through some of the big stories coming out of Africa. Then we'll change tack entirely. In tribute to the new issue of the magazine, we'll begin a series on Italy, and today it's all about quality of life. All that, plus we head to Dusseldorf to catch up with our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, at the year's big retail event, Euroshop, and we'll also review some of the week's best art exhibitions with Ossian Ward of the Listen Gallery. That's Midori House, with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So, much to look forward to, as you would expect, from Midori House. And before all of that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines from around the world.
The co-pilot of a hijacked Ethiopian Airlines flight has surrendered to Swiss authorities in Geneva after commandeering his aircraft to seek asylum in Switzerland, police said today. The plane's second-in-command was named by the Ethiopian government official and has served Ethiopian Airlines for 5 years. Ethiopia's government communications affairs minister, Redwan Hussein, said he was not carrying a weapon and took control of the plane when the pilot left the cockpit to use the lavatory.
Haile Medihin Abera Tagin. He's 31. He's been serving for the airlines for the last 5 years. So far as known that he was medically sane. The intention as to what forced him to hijack his own plane is still beggars belief and description. So we still wait until the investigation is concluded.
The Western and Arab-backed Syrian Free Army has sacked its leader, General Salim Idris, and replaced him with a more experienced field commander as part of a revamp of moderate forces fighting President Bashar al-Assad, opposition sources have said today. The decision was prompted by what was called a stalemate on the ground and to ensure best leadership for future operations. A United Nations report has accused North Korean security chiefs and possibly even the Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un of ordering systematic torture, starvation and mass killings bordering on genocide. Roseanne Rifay is head of East Asia at Amnesty International.
The horrible accounts of the public executions that many people were forced to witness, the people who were killed by hammer blows and forced to dig their own graves, these just horrible things that are incomprehensible to most of us, and to hear these people calmly reporting it and having the courage to come out and describe this not only to us but to the public and the international community is really quite astounding.
The European Union has suspended sanctions on 8 of Zimbabwe's most powerful military and political figures on Monday, but kept them on President Robert Mugabe and his wife in a cautious easing of policy after last year's disputed elections. The 28-nation EU, which imposed sanctions on Zimbabwe back in 2002 in protest at human rights abuses and violations of democracy under Mugabe, has gradually eased sanctions over the last few years to encourage political reform. A number of people seeking asylum in Australia have been injured and some arrested after an overnight incident in the Manus Island Detention Centre in nearby Papua New Guinea. Australia's Immigration Minister Scott Morrison said on Monday Papua New Guinea police located and returned 35 people after they tried to escape.
Service providers have reported minor damage to the centre. A couple of light poles inside the perimeter were knocked down. Several internal and external fences were knocked over. Several glass panels on marquee doors were smashed. However, they are made of safety glass and remain intact. A shade tent was thrown over the fence and a couple of bunk beds were broken apart.
And finally, like most Americans of a certain age, President Barack Obama is starting to complain about the aches and pains of getting older. Obama told retired National Basketball Association star Charles Barkley that he was limiting his basketball playing to about once a month because he said, things happen. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
The ever young Jonathan Wheatley there with the news headlines. More from him halfway through the show at the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're right back after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It is just turning 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the big stories coming out of Africa, a bit of an African focus today, are James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, and Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Martin, James, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking about CAR, we're going to talk about South Africa, we're going to talk about Uganda, but we're going to start with Somalia. A confidential UN monitors report obtained by Reuters and AP alleges that arms are being diverted from the Somali government, in part to Al-Shabaab. This comes after the UN dropped an arms embargo on Mogadishu, but also a campaign by the Somali government to regain control of the country from that very same militant group. James Schneider, at first glance, this looks bizarre. It's the Somali government is accused of selling weapons to an organisation it's fighting. Is it bizarre, or is it just, you know, Somali business as usual?
I think people are starting to see that the Somali government is slightly different from what they hoped it would be when it came in with some, you know, reasonably great fanfare. I think the thing that's perhaps more interesting but less headline worthy in this is, rather than the arms going to Al-Shabaab, the claims that they're funding to sub-clan militia and that it's the president's militia that is receiving funding. And when you kind of put that into the context that the government is coming under increasing criticism for this kind of clan-based state organisation, and the idea that the state is coming back in some kind of useful format is slightly challenged, it doesn't look very good.
Martin, we should probably put this in a bit of context, that the Somali government is not a government in the way that most people would recognise, is it? It's not elected. It's been appointed in a rather strange way, which makes sure that it takes in as many of the major clans involved in Somalia as possible. Yeah. And as James was saying, a lot of those clans still have links to their own militia.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, nothing changes in Somalia. There are 3.5 clans with many sub-clans. And somebody once said many years ago, and it was about the one thing you really need to remember about Somalia, is that when you understand the Somali clan system, it's time to leave the Horn of Africa. It's just so complicated. But essentially, everybody favours their own group. And everything breaks down essentially to your two clan politics in the end. And, you know, the report that's come out now, it was an exclusive leak to Reuters, is something that's been said for years. I remember a couple of years ago hearing reports that, trucks were being loaded with weapons and being driven into the Baraka market and being just sold off to anybody. I mean, sometimes to Al-Shabaab, sometimes to anybody else. All of this just to make money for either the president's clan or somebody else's clan, and everybody just looks after themselves. It's a very simple system, and it works extremely well.
And it doesn't help exactly the system of electing or selecting the parliament and the government. The fact that outside entities, Western countries, all the rest of it, were very, very keen on institutionalizing this clan-based system within the so-called 4.5. Because you put in the smaller subclans into one half grouping, which means that the clan is heightened within the an emerging Somali state or a new Somali state. Whilst exactly as Martin says, it's always going to be a large factor. It's been given even greater precedence in the kind of institutional structure of the new government.
Martin, are we getting to a point where we realise that actually Western involvement in Somalia actually doesn't do much good? I remember when I was covering the Horn of Africa from 2006 onwards, every time I wrote about Somalia, I'd write, well, it's a country which hasn't had a central government in a generation, that's had 13 attempts at international brokering of a new government. It's still failing. You know, these stories came around again and again and again, and yet always there would be Britain, America, the United Nations as a whole saying, don't worry, this time we're going to sort it out. This time we've got this new president that we're going to try and get in there, and he's going to be good this time.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, the thing one has to remember about the way this government was selected was that it was said absolutely categorically, we are not going to have those old warlords in. Absolutely, definitively not. And then at the last moment, the warlords said, well, if you don't want us in, we'll be out. And if you want us out, we'll take all our militia with us, and you see what happens then. And everybody looked at this for a while and thought, no. And so all the warlords just went back in. But I mean, you know, one shouldn't forget that there are something like, I don't know, a dozen different states or statelets in what is Somalia. So you have the Somali government, then you have Puntland, then you have Somaliland, which is sort of semi-recognized, and then you have a whole series of other ones, Azania. I mean, I have no idea where these places are or what they really represent. But, you know, most of them just live in Kenya, in the presidents, and sort of pretend to be a real entity. And some are real and some are not. And, you know, that's life in Somalia. But there's no point in pretending that it's anything else. That is what it is. And you can only have limited control or influence over it. And that's the reality.
And again, James, to put this in a slightly more context, of course, the reason why the West in particular has been so keen to have some form of structure in Somalia, someone they can deal with, is that they see Somalia as a place where there are militant groups that don't just have their eye on Somalia, but have their eye on things further afield.
Yeah, so it's Al-Shabaab, the militant group, which has allied itself with Al-Qaeda, which has broader sort of regional aims as well as some kind of sort of Islamist Somali nationalist aims. And yeah, that's the kind of overriding interest has been for Western countries, at least in the last sort of almost 10 years or so, has been, right, we're just kind of worried about this space being controlled by extremists, which really narrows down the way people view about it. All the kind of nuance and context that Martin was saying tends to get lost in the, right, well, we've got to fight the terrorists.
But I think one other thing to remember is that everybody wants a finger in this pie. So the other thing that the report that's just come out mentions is that an unnamed Gulf state, it's probably Dubai, has been flying weapons into Somalia as well. They want their part of the pie. You have Kenya, which now occupies the southern chunk of the Somalia. You have Ethiopia, which also is involved. I mean, you know, it's always said you shouldn't have peacekeepers from neighbouring states because they always get involved. So, I mean, you know, this is just a pie that everyone wants a bit of, but that's where we are, and there's no point in pretending we're anywhere else. That is what's going to continue.
James, you mentioned nuance and how that's often ignored. Let's move on to another big story of the moment in Africa where nuance is perhaps hard to come by, and that's Central African Republic. There was this Amnesty International report last week talking about ethnic cleansing by Christian militias of Muslims. There's peacekeepers going in there from France, from the African Union. Is there a danger? Because there's been a number of things mentioned, partly because it's 20 years on from Rwanda, partly because some of those AU troops are from Rwanda as well. The word genocide has been used, ethnic cleansing. Is there a danger that this becomes told in a very black and white way, which doesn't necessarily help solve this problem?
Yes, but I think it's even more complicated than that. Because the narrative was very quickly told as being intercommunal, being Muslims versus Christians, and for a number of reasons that wasn't quite right. But as the violence has continued, it has become subjectively true. The people who violence either is done to them, are doing the violence, or see violence done around them, are increasingly viewing it through the prism of religion or within religious identity. It's not when the anti-Balaka spokesman come out, that it's never anything about the Muslim practice. It's never anything about Muslim beliefs. It's Muslim as this identity. So it's a kind of, and it's interesting that it's taken on the kind of nexus of hatred is in the term Muslim, when before it was in foreigner.
And it's also become very much tit for tat in the sense that, I mean, tit for tat's a horrible sort of phrase which doesn't do it justice, but the idea that, you know, these attacks are taking place because of another attack that's taken place beforehand,
and that helps intensify it becoming more religious. But going back to the big G word that is being thrown out, it's just inaccurate, and it is unhelpful, because as soon as you say the word genocide, it means certain things, as in certain responses are required, and you have to interpret it through a certain lens. So if you're saying genocide, you mean it is organized, it is planned, it is systematic. There is a central authority that you need to effectively take down. That is the international involvement essentially has to be partial in one side to prevent it. And really the situation is different and more complicated, and also much more kind of decentralized. A lot of the kind of worst horrific crimes that we're seeing, the lynchings and so on and so forth, they're not really by any organized militia. I mean, there's this guy who claims he's the head of the anti-Balaka forces, and they are linked to some military things, but there's lots of just violence emerging out of the streets.
And Martin, part of the problem here is that when you insert peacekeepers, which are on the whole being sent with, you know, for very good reasons to try and keep the peace, but if you insert them into this situation where, as James says, there isn't, you know, one force that needs to be quelled, there isn't one political leader who needs to be in some way brought round, that it seems the most that these peacekeepers can do is drive around the country, and if they see someone about to be lynched, try and stop it happen.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, I'm all in favour of
that's
trying
than nothing.
To... Exactly.
No, I'm not saying it shouldn't be done, but it's very much sort of, you know, a Band-Aid solution rather than a...
Absolutely. And I'm all in favour of trying to stop people being lynched. It is a disaster. But, you know, there is something, and I think one needs to bear in mind. Look, the Christians in the capital essentially was... there's only 20% of the population are Muslim. The Christians in the capital live quite happily with the Muslim population, who are mostly traders. Then you get the rebels who come down, and they are almost solidly, but not quite... Muslims, from some of them from Chad, some of them from Sudan, and arrive in their capital and basically take over and slaughter a lot of Christians. So people were absolutely incandescent. And there's a friend of mine who's Chadian and himself a Christian, which is, you know, not what one thinks of in Chad. He said, look, the people there didn't want to have a replication of the situation in Chad. In Chad, Chad has been ruled exclusively by the north, by the Muslims. And a lot of people in Central African Republic thought, we do not want to have a dictatorship by Muslims who've come in from the north, from places like Sudan, from Chad, brought with them all their weapons, and are an extension of Chadian foreign policy to control this area. That is how a lot of Christians looked at it. And they thought, this is our only chance. We're going to make sure they're gone.
And for those reasons, it's really important that we shouldn't be stripping everything down with just the genocide term, because the Muslims who mainly form Seleka are actually of a different ethnic, linguistic and historical grouping to those who are the victims of most of the violence in the northwest and in the capital. So it's really this idea of identity that has been attached and linked these, you know, mainly basically Fulani people who've suffered the violence from fighters who were mainly Arabic speaking.
And James, do you see some similarities with what happened in Mali, in that you've got the situation where, as Martin says, there were fighters that have come in, rebels that were not really from northern Mali, a lot of them. And you then had a lot of sort of reaction towards those Muslims, those Tuaregs living in the north of Mali, when a lot of them hadn't been involved with the groups that were doing the original fighting.
I mean, maybe a bit, but it is kind of different, because a lot of the claims of foreignness that have been attached to the Seleka rebels are basically our propaganda. There are mercenaries who come from over the border, but lots of reports have been saying, oh, they're all foreign because they're speaking Arabic. But the northeast of the country does speak Sudanese Arabic, so that's rather normal. And this idea that it's foreign people who are coming in is the oldest narrative in Central African politics. It's what Bouazizi has always used against his opponents, saying they're Chadian. Patisse used it against Bouazizi, saying that he was Chadian and he was using Chadian support. So I'm just slightly nervous about using this foreign thing.
Martin Plaut, just finally, when we look at the role that the African Union is playing or is thinking of playing in the CAR, how confident are you that they are getting it right, and that they know what they're doing?
Well, I'd be very surprised if they knew what they were doing. I mean, they just are not a coherent operation. I mean, they've been trying to sort out Sudan for a decade or so, and have got nowhere. I mean, they just don't have the leverage. They don't have the weapons. They don't have the intelligence. They don't have the capability. And frankly, at the heart of it, they don't have the political will. Do you think that the Angolan government, for example, which is wealthy beyond belief, gives a damn about the Central African Republic? As far as they're concerned, they can go hang. And if you don't have the support of your members, just like the United Nations, you are a bankrupt and defunct organization. And frankly, that's where the AU really is.
We'll take a short break there. Martin Plaut, James Schneider will talk more about South Africa and Uganda right after this. You're listening to Midori House.
What is it to be typically German? Well, Rolf Sachs, a half-German, half-French artisan designer, explores the clichés that form his notion of a nation in a new exhibition at Köln's Museum of Applied Arts. Culture editor Robert Bound went to sort the Schadenfreude from the Sehnsucht.
There are certain very clear clichés, which obviously are part of the show. Punctuality, industriousness, hard-working. But I wanted to show the full depth of really German character. We always say that we are the nation of poets and thinkers, and there is always this being torn between the mind and the rationality.
Typisch Deutsch, a Robert Bound film now showing on Monocle.com.
The Monocle subscription package is your year-round entry into the world of Monocle. For £90, you get a year of Monocle in print. And that's 10 magazines, including two double issues and our two seasonal newspapers, Alpino and Mediterraneo. You'll get access to online archives and an exclusive tote bag designed by our in-house team and made by our friends at Ruto to Japan. Plus, free shipping to wherever you are in the world. And that's all for £90 sterling. Or you can double your fun with our two-year package for £170, which comes with two bags and our exclusive organiser. So treat yourself, or even a loved one, to a Monocle subscription, available at monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. I'm still with James Schneider from Think Africa Press and Martin Plaut from the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. We're going to turn now to Uganda, where President Yoweri Museveni has suggested he may pass an anti-gay and lesbian law, which he says is based on scientific evidence that homosexuality is not hereditary, not genetics, but behavioural. The law will not only criminalise homosexuality, but will also make it a crime to not report homosexuality. Sexual acts, it says. Members of the LGBT community could face life imprisonment. James Schneider, Museveni has kind of gone this way and that over this bill, and it's been something that's been discussed for quite some time in Uganda. How much does it matter whether he signs it or not?
I think it's important whether he signs it, but first I think we need to understand what this bill is, why it's been kicking around for 5 years, and why Museveni says, oh yeah, yeah, let's bring that forward, and then, oh no, let's not, let's cool it down, which in itself has been amping up homophobic views and you know, homophobic hate crimes and all the rest of it. This bill was introduced originally as a private member's bill in 2009, by a backbench MP from Museveni's party, from the ruling party. And basically, all the way its passage in Parliament has always been, it gets Museveni's support, it gets lots of newspaper headlines, it always gets brought up when there's some other scandal that he wants to distract from, some corruption scandal to do with oil in Lake Albert and things like that. And then, obviously, it's not going to be very good for Uganda's foreign relations. And Uganda plays a very important kind of regional foreign policy role. It's got strong ties with the US and all the rest of it. So he doesn't really want to jeopardize those things. So he brings it out. It's useful for him. And then he calms it down again. And we're perhaps getting to the point where he can't put the genie mm-hmm. back in the bottle, where he's stirred up, or he's allowed to be stirred up, so much homophobic feeling that he will have to sign it.
And Martin, this is similar games that Good Luck Jonathan has been playing in Nigeria, in the sense that there's been all sorts of other scandals there. And all of a sudden, he's found that actually an anti-gay bill is quite good politics.
Well, I hate to say it, but, you know, in Africa, there is vast amount of support for these kind of measures. And the only thing that really stops it in a way is the fact that it is so unpopular internationally. I mean, Susan Rice tweeted that she had, President Obama's national security advisor, basically tweeted that she had been on the phone for a lengthy conversation with President Museveni on Saturday. Now, you know, if you get the ear of somebody like that, you're doing fine. But, that's the only thing, as far as I can tell, that is preventing it from being brought into force, because it would be tremendously popular.
And James, that's not just in Uganda and not just in Nigeria, but we're seeing this across Africa.
Yes, and it's true, and that there are large problems with homophobia and all the rest of it. But in every instance when it's brought in so far, it's been brought in for heavily political reasons. It's used to avoid some other subject. And it's not like governments, this is their kind of largest priority in any way, but they just use it to avoid talking about something else. And it's very successful. It really does avoid talking about anything else. It goes on the front page and everything else gets put to the back.
It was very interesting looking at the coverage in Kenya of Binyavanga Wainaina's thing that his piece that he released explained that he was gay. The way that the Daily Nation newspaper tried to deal with someone who, up until that moment, Martin, they had always heralded as, you know, a Kenyan icon, and now suddenly he was saying, "Well, I'm gay." I mean, they seem to really struggle with how do we cope with this, because he's not a foreigner. He's not someone that we can say, you know, has brought in this thing. And there are little things like that, aren't there, that seem to suggest that there are some struggles going on.
Oh, I think there are. One of the most interesting things is that in South Africa, a gay couple actually went to court because the constitution that was brought in said there will be no discrimination on race, on gender, on sexuality. This was a constitution which was adopted by the ANC. I think they didn't look at the small print very carefully.
I'm not entirely sure everyone in the ANC believed in it.
No, they were totally opposed to bring it in. But to the ANC's credit, when it came in and was endorsed by the Constitutional Court, they basically said, yes, we accept it. And it was forced through Parliament by the ANC with lots of grinding of teeth. But it's now legal to be married and gay in South Africa. It's one of the few places in the world, as you know, where this is the case.
There we are, South Africa showing a semblance of leadership. Let's move on to Africa now, just before you both go. Elections are due later this year, by May. They'll possibly be in April. Martin, before
no,
you...
No, definitely May.
Definitely May. Okay. And you should know, because you're going to not just be to not be an impartial journalist there, are you? You'll be working for the opposition, for the Democratic Alliance.
Absolutely. I'm working for the Democratic Alliance, and I'll be working in the media department. I've decided to do this. It's an odd thing for me to do, since my own background is in the South African trade union movement. It's in the South African left. So what on earth am I doing assisting a sort of centre-right party, I mean, which has links with the British Liberal Party, not with the left, with the Socialist International and the Labour Party, of which I'm a member. Why am I doing it? Well, my view is that one should first and foremost be a Democrat. And frankly, the ANC has had it much too easy for much too long. After 20 years, they are rotten from top to bottom. I mean, there are vast numbers of allegations of corruption from everybody, from Jacob Zuma down to local councillors. And this should be challenged by a more powerful Democratic force. So I've just decided to put my money where my mouth is. If I've gone on slagging off people for years about corruption and the things that are wrong with South Africa, I better go and do something about it.
But the thing is, you know, many former ANC voters might be listening to that and going, well, I agree with you, Martin, but there's no way I'm voting for a white-dominated party like the Democratic Alliance, a party that can't seem to even get its house in order. We had this complete farce a couple of weeks ago with, you know, who its presidential candidate is, and it's a supposed union with another party.
With a Hung, yes.
Yeah, which, I mean, you know, made your new friends look like fools, didn't it?
Absolutely. It was a complete own goal. But on the other hand, one's got to say two things. The first is that the Democratic Alliance's credentials on race issues are absolutely rock solid. After all, they come out of the Progressive Party, which was the one white party in South Africa that has always been completely opposed to racism in every form. And you had Helen Suzman, who stood up as the only person who took that position for 13 years. She was on her own in Parliament. Amazing record. The second thing is that, you know, there are many black faces in the Democratic Alliance. Yes, the person at the top, Helen Zillow, who's a personal friend of mine, is white. But quite frankly, who cares? At the end of the day, South Africa's got to get it beyond racism and beyond politics and live by the ANC's own slogan. South Africa belongs to all who live in her, black and white.
James Schneider, Martin Platt's got a point here, is that, you know, the DA is the only opposition, really, isn't there? We've had Cope, which couldn't cope. We've had various others that have sort of fluttered and flitted away. Some people might like the idea of a Julius Malema-led party, but a lot of ANC voters might not like that.
Not if you don't want your toothbrush nationalised.
You know, is part of the problem here that there just isn't more of a ANC-like alternative to the ANC?
Yes, but I think that will develop. I mean, I respect Martin's decision. I think if I were in the same case, I wouldn't do that. But I absolutely see the arguments why. But I think change is more likely to come from within the ANC and within the ANC's own alliance. So there's lots of pressure from its left. There's lots of pressure within the trade union movement. NUMSA, the trade union, has split off, and they're probably going to, if not for this election, but 2019, there will be a non-Malema left alternative to the ANC.
But the SACP, the Communist Party, hasn't split. COSATU hasn't split. They're still part of that coalition.
Well, COSATU is splitting internally. COSATU, as the NUM-dominated body, is not going to leave the ANC. Absolutely not. But different unions within COSATU will, and there will be splits within trade unions. And so there will be this other alternative that will develop. And it is important that there is another alternative that is not so rooted in kind of pragmatic gradualist liberalism, which is a kind of one way to say what the DA is, because South Africa has enormous deep-seated problems, and it needs really radical change in order to do that. None of the current parties are offering the sort of radical change that's required, though.
Martin Platt, I'm sure, would like to respond to that, but I'm afraid we've got no time. thank you both, James Schneider from Think Africa Press and Martin Platt, soon to be a flack for the DA. who'd have thought? Thank you both for coming on to Midori House. Lots more to come in the second half hour.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monaco 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Monaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monaco, vada se che che che.
From London,
London. London, cara.
De long, de long.
This is Monaco 24.
So we're at the bottom of the hour, just beyond actually, because we went on a little bit. Still to come, we're going to be looking at quality of life in Italy. David Pleasant will be here. We'll also be reviewing a little bit of art. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. The co-pilot of a hijacked Ethiopian Airlines flight has surrendered to Swiss authorities in Geneva after commandeering his aircraft to seek asylum in Switzerland, police have said today. The plane's second in command was named by Ethiopian government officials and has served Ethiopian Airlines for 5 years. The Western Arab-backed Syrian Free Army has sacked its leader, General Salim Idris, and replaced him with a more experienced field commander as part of a revamp of moderate forces fighting President Bashar al-Assad, oppositions have now said. The decision was prompted by what was called a stalemate on the ground and to ensure best leadership for future operations. The European Union has suspended sanctions on eight of Zimbabwe's most powerful military and political figures today, but kept them on President Robert Mugabe and his wife in a cautious easing of policy after last year's disputed elections. The 28-nation EU has gradually eased sanctions over the last few years to encourage political reform. And a number of people seeking asylum in Australia have been injured and some arrested after an overnight incident at the Manus Island Detention Centre in nearby Papua New Guinea. Australia's immigration minister has admitted today. Papua New Guinea police located and returned 35 people after they tried to escape. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. It is 19:34 in Milan, 18:34 here in London. All this week on Midori House, we're going to be exploring the theme of the new edition of Monocle magazine. Here it is. I'm sure you've received it if you're a subscriber. If you haven't, you might just have to wait until Wednesday. The theme is Italy. And I say all this week on Midori House, we're going to be looking at, delving inside the issue. And David Pleasant has joined me today. Hello, David.
Hi, Steve.
Because we're going to be starting with one of the first stories, which you and I worked on, which was all about Italy's quality of life.
That's right. And yeah.
There we are. Now, it's interesting because one of the things that always comes up when we do our quality of life survey, one of the sort of the constant letter that you always get every summer is, why are there no Italian cities? There is never any Italian city that makes our top 25. And there are very good reasons for that, aren't there? Why don't you give us the reasons, David, for why they don't ever quite normally cut the mustard?
Well, it's kind of complex, isn't it, Steve? Because the quality of life survey takes into account all sorts of things, all sorts of criteria. And I think if you look at them across the board, a lot of Italian cities, as much as we love them, they don't really cut the mustard when it comes to things like infrastructure, things like public transport, things like opportunities for young people, for entrepreneurs, for starting new businesses. Because of all the reasons that we know, you know, we all love Italy, but it has certain systemic problems and that's reflected in its cities.
However, it does have lots of cities that we rather like. So what we've chosen to do in this issue is look at what we feel is the best big city, the best small, the best northern, the best southern, the best mountain and the best island city. And we won't go through all of them, but I think maybe let's go through some of the sort of the more surprising ones that that perhaps would be a bit interesting. Should we start in the south? With Palermo, which is, I think, one of my favourite Italian cities. It's got some of the best food. It's got some of the best weather. As we know, the infrastructure isn't wonderful. It's not the best place to get around on by bus. What is it about Palermo which makes it appeal to you?
Well, I think it's a mixture of things. Firstly, we have to say it's a big metropolis. It's got the services of a big city. So, you know, it's loaded with culture. It's loaded with theatres. It's got, you know, if you want a cinema, it's got scores of cinema. If you want, you know, independent art, contemporary art galleries, you know, we could name dozens. It's just got the kind of cultural infrastructure that perhaps some of the northern cities that come off very well in terms of economy and kind of opportunities. It just beats them, hands down.
Now, we cheated a little bit because the next one I want to talk about is Cagliari, which we describe as our best island city, best island slash coastal city, which obviously Palermo could have been as well. But, you know, never mind. What is it about Cagliari? Because, I mean, it's very different, isn't it? I mean, Sardinia is no Sicily. It's got its stuff together a little bit more, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very different island. The population's much smaller. Sardinia has big open spaces. It has large farms. It has, you know, a big kind of mentality, big sky, big landscape. So the city, its capital kind of reflects that. It has a very kind of outdoorsy lifestyle. It's one of the greenest cities in Italy. They've recently converted a large lagoon on the outskirts of the city into a huge park. It is one of the largest urban parks in Italy. A wonderful large beach at Poetto, which is, you know, 8 to 10 kilometres long. You know, if you go there, you'll just be, people are always on their bikes, or either windsurfing, jogging or kayaking or whatever else. It's that kind of place.
Yeah, I don't know whether sort of windsurfing, jogging and kayaking is necessarily sort of necessarily works for me.
All in the same day.
Oh, OK. Well, if it's all in the same day, that's fine. Finally, let's talk about Trento, which we named as our best mountain city. And it's And Trento, you know, is just is quite near Bolzano, which is again a city that we've looked at in some depth. Again, actually, in this issue, we look at an interesting banker from Bolzano, which is easy for me to say. But Trento, why do we choose that as our mountain city?
Well, we probably should reference a source that we did actually use within this survey. Anyway, we did actually use Il Sole 24 Ore's own quality of life ranking, and Trento comes top of that. That was kind of an inspiration, perhaps, for us to choose it as our best mountain city. Trento is, you know, like its neighbour Bolzano, it's got a wonderful mountain way of life. The mountains are literally on the doorstep. It's got all the food and wine of the surrounding vineyards. It's also on a kind of it is on an important economic trade route. The Milan to Munich kind of route influences the kind of business opportunities that there are in that city as well.
And as you say, we were inspired somewhat by Il Sole 24's own survey. They look at 107 towns and cities across Italy. I'm afraid to say that one of your favourite cities, Naples, is slap bang bottom of the 107. But there we are. Never mind, eh?
I know, poor old Naples. I mean, it is a bit of a shame, but the head of that survey actually does concede that some cities that are very low down are nonetheless very nice places to live. They've got their strengths.
They've got their thing, haven't
exactly.
they? And after all, it is Italy. David Pleasant, thank you very much indeed. We're going to have lots more about Italy throughout the week here on Midori House. Next, though, we're in Dusseldorf.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. We head now to Dusseldorf, where the world's biggest retail expo, EuroShop, is shutting up shop after a busy first day. With pressures on bricks and mortar stores around the world like never before, Monocle 24 has been there all week to find out what the innovators, originators and creative minds at the event have in mind to measure up to the new challenges. A little earlier, I caught up with our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and, of course, Tom Edwards, to find out whether the mood was buoyant at the expo. I can hear the clinking of glasses and a lot of activity going on behind you. The afternoon seems to be a rather enjoyable sort of time to be at EuroShop, doesn't it?
Well, I think that Tom Edwards is going to put his feet up, Steve, because he tucked into not just our sound engineer, Sam Imbe's polenta and side of pork, but I think he also snarfed back about two plates of very, very nice raviolis as well. So he's fine. It's going to be nap time for him as well. But no one else is napping here.
Okay,
it is incredibly buzzy. Like so many of these German trade fairs, you know, the Messe defines cities like, you know, Cologne with its furniture fair. Obviously, electronics being in Hanover, and Dusseldorf has many things. Of course, it's got a massive shoe fair, globally renowned, a big wine fair. But every 3 years, EuroShop rolls into town, and you can see why it's every 3 years, because the stand that we're on, just looking behind where Tom is, I mean, this is, you know, an event. It's only here for less than a week. They've built a full elevator just to deal with all of the catering. And behind where Tom is sitting is this wonderful round table. It's probably made from pine, or it could be larch. Anyway, a very prominent tree from Sudtirol on this particular stand. We're on the Schweizer stand here, and people are tucking into Lardo and Speck and lots of nice regional wines. And there's even business being done as well.
Well, I'm glad there's a little bit of business being done there. It's not just food and drink. Tyler, Tom, tell us about the type of person that comes to EuroShop. Who is it that you've been seeing so far?
Well, Steve, I mean, we've been catching up with not just, obviously, you know, the biggest names in shop fitting, the actual designers, the minds behind these spaces, but also, you know, the retailers as well. It's very dynamic, a very sort of creative environment, and it's interesting that you see, walking around the stands, a lot of the cues that you recognise from some of the big players in retail all around the world. You can see what, you know, the origins of them. You can see where the ideas came from. And Tyler's quite right what he was saying before about, you know, the Germans having this whole kind of Messe culture in lockdown. I remember I was at the motor show in Frankfurt last year. Nobody does it quite like the Germans. I don't know how they managed to get it so right time after time.
No, I think obviously it says that, you know, the world wants to flock to all these German cities because there are no shortage of very nice sausage stands everywhere you walk, you know, and these are independent operators. Aside from just on the stand, there's, you know, all over the place. You have these small little imbisses selling bratwurst, weisswurst, and everything else. But I think going back to your question as well, it is, if you're looking for refrigeration because you have one of the biggest retail food outlets in Taiwan, you would want to come here. If you are struggling to rethink how your bookstore business should be and it needs to be remerchandised in a different way, and you're based in Brazil, you're probably here. So you've got H&M and the Zaras and all of the major department stores, anyone's visual merchandising teams, anyone's architecture teams, store planning, investor groups. So, you know, those are the clients that are here. And then you've got everyone offering, you know, lighting to carpeting to, of course, then design solutions as well.
That's right, Stephen. I should just say, as well as reminding our listeners to dip into the archive and listen to the briefing from earlier today, we've already had some great guests with us. We're back tomorrow, of course, at noon London time, 1300 here. Some of those themes that Tyler's identified there will be things we'll be discussing. Maybe a little about sustainability, lighting, a major factor. So we'll be kind of unpicking the bones of that on tomorrow's programme as well. So plenty still to come from here in Düsseldorf.
And Tyler, just before I let you go, I mean, what are the big differences that you've spotted so far this year at EuroShop compared to its previous iterations?
Well, I think one of the things we were talking to our host, Bernard Schweitzer, about, the particular stand that we're on, they've created this massive department store. Now, what is Schweitzer selling? They're selling various concepts. They want, you know, if you are a major department store, you need to rethink your food hall, then you will come on their stand and they are really provoking their potential customers with various ideas. What can they do to get ahead of the competition? What they've done very differently, though, like so many trade fairs where everything is top secret and no one wants their neighbors to see what they're showing their clients, they've been very bold. Their stand is completely open. Now, it doesn't mean everyone can come on it, but you can see what's going on inside. So it is this massive pine, larch, Alto Adige wooden structure, and then it's just all surrounded in glass and perspex in this sort of very sort of cozy environment. So you can look in, but you can't necessarily touch, smell, or even hear, because of course Tom a little bit earlier saw a very interesting sound installation of ceramic sort of glockenspiel.
That's right. It was a full sensory overload, Steve. Not just the things that look enticing and feel enticing, but sound enticing as well. Schweitzer's really checked everything on the hit list. So we even had I was able to play the plates, if you'll believe.
Well, there we are.
It's a new segment there, Steve.
It is. It is. We'll do that every week on Midori House. That's a promise. We will. Our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and Tom Edwards there on his plates. And you can hear more from the team in Düsseldorf, 1200 hours London time, 1300 hours German time. That's tomorrow when they'll be hosting the briefing from the EuroShop Expo. We're going to be talking art in a moment, but first some music. And since it's Italian week, here's Postcard from Italy by Beirut.
Times we had, oh, when the wind would blow with rain and snow, we're not all bad. We put our features where they had to go.
That was Beirut there with a postcard from Italy. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Nearing the end, but still long enough to go. Time for our weekly art review. I'm very pleased to say that Ossian Ward, head of content at the Listen Gallery here in London, has joined me in the studio. Ossian, welcome to Midori House.
Hi.
We've got a couple of Richards, a couple of Tates, and then if we've got time, we'll talk about Isaac Julian as well. But let's begin with Richard Deacon. For those who don't know him, sum up this Turner Prize winner in, there we are, there's three words there.
Yeah, Richard, use those. The first of the Richards is a sculptor who came along with what we call the new generation of British sculptors, which included people like Anish Kapoor and Richard Long. And they kind of came after the whole Henry Moore, Anthony Caro, that kind of era of sculptors. So they started to disassemble what we know as sculpture. So he was at school at the same time as Gilbert and George. So that gives you an idea of the kind of the way they decided to take it apart. And
there's that sort of playfulness and the sort of the weird and the wonderful in his sculpture as well, isn't there, that you find in, say, Gilbert and George?
Yeah, I mean, he's not a performance artist. He's resolutely a sculptor. So you might think, doesn't sound very traditional. You know, he sounds like an ordinary sculptor who just builds things. And he calls himself a fabricator rather than a sculptor. But it's quite hard to sum up because there's 40 works in a million different materials. So what I quite like is he gives a lecture in which he lists all the different materials he works in. And I won't say the whole thing, but it begins clay, plaster, limestone, marble, serpentine, oak, ash, beech, lime, pine, teak, ebony, mahogany, bamboo, plywood, and on and on and on. And on. Yeah. And that gives you an idea of the variety. So you have things that tower above you. You have things that are on the floor. These works from, I think, the 80s called Art for Other People, which were meant to be small domestic style works that could be kind of displayed in the house or given to your neighbour. You know, they weren't meant to be grand statements of sculpture. They're all somehow playing with what is organic, what is man-made, what is, you know, the idea that a thought could become an object. He's playing with these very, you're right, it's very playful.
And the exhibition at Tate Britain, how big a deal is that for him right now? Because it's not quite a retrospective, but it's work over the last three or four decades.
Yeah, that's a difficult one because he doesn't want it to be a retrospective. I suppose no artist wants to have that.
It feels a bit like the end then,
yeah,
doesn't it?
It's like the...
Here's what you've done.
Here's your sticker. Now toddle off into old age. He's very much didn't want it to be seen as that, but the Tate have managed to corral a lot of good work together. So, for instance, when you come in, there's this giant green ceramic piece in the foyer downstairs at Tate Britain, where they never normally have sculpture. You associate it upstairs in the beautiful Duveen galleries, but downstairs, you know, the galleries are a bit lower, but actually they managed to squeeze in this amazing ceramic sculpture called Fold, which is a beautiful green ceramics that you kind of walk around and it is literally folded like a concertina or like a curtain. But the exhibition, I love it because it lacks the kind of usual Tate stamp, which is first room, early work, second
room.
Well,
that's what I was going to say, because often the Tate, certainly Tate Modern indeed, you know, when they do, you know, if we can call them retrospectives, but look back on the last 40 years, it tends to be very much, it follows a pattern of a chronological order.
Yeah.
And this doesn't?
No, this doesn't. And it doesn't try and patronise you by saying in each room, oh, this is the room with the wooden stuff in it, or this is the room where he experimented with this. In fact, there are no kind of wall text labels like that. So, you know, I think it's much more visceral. It's much more, you know, how you're going to enjoy it in the moment. And I think that's nice. It makes it less like a retrospective.
Let's move from one Richard at one Tate to another Richard, another Tate. And this very much is a retrospective. Richard Hamilton at the Tate Modern.
Yeah, he died, you know, in 2011, 2012, but, you know, at the ripe old age of 90 or so. So it's definitely a survey. It's so big that they couldn't fit it just into Tate Modern. So you also have to kind of travel across town to the ICA, where they've got two of his very earliest works. And these, he didn't even call these works, they were exhibition designs. So there's one called Man, Machine and Motion and one called Growth on Form. And they were basically display units showing old photographs, old objects that somehow told a story about where man was or where philosophy or thinking was at that time. He didn't really see them as works of art in their own right. But if you go and see them, these kind of immersive installations where you get to look at these amazing old photographs of men on motorbikes or men going into them, you know, into a space rocket or astronauts, or the growth on form is more about sort of cells and biology and little quirky objects. The more you think about, oh, this is what contemporary art looks like. And this was 1940s, 50s, going into the early 60s when he famously invented pop art.
And it, so is he, in the sense, one of those artists that you can see his influence in a lot of people's work right now and in the last 20 or 30 years, but perhaps hasn't really got the recognition he previously deserved?
Yeah, and he could, because he, quote-unquote, invented pop art, he could have just carried on doing that. He could have become the British Andy Warhol, because he started making these collages out of found American magazines and advertisements that really attracted him. He wasn't being cynical. He enjoyed this influx of stuff. But then he thought, no, to hell with that. I'm going to go and study Marcel Duchamp. And he took a whole 5 years in the middle of the 60s to go and study Duchamp and reinvent one of the famous works called The Large Glass, Marcel Duchamp's, you know, crowning achievement, and curate shows about him, and then go off and start meddling with computers before anyone had thought about, you know, how to mix computer imagery and photographic imagery and painting. So he just kept moving, and that's why you'll see the influences the whole way through. You'll think, oh, hold on a minute, you know, he did a bit of photorealist painting. Oh, hold on a minute, he did installation art before anyone else did. So he just kept moving. He didn't stop. He didn't stick to one style.
One of the things that strikes me about these two shows,
the
two Richards, yeah, at the two Tates, is, yeah, why are they at two Tates? Because, you know, why is one at Tate Britain and one at Tate Modern? Surely, you know, Tate Modern should be the home for, you know, for more recent art.
Yeah, and I think you're getting into a world of pain here, which I can't even begin to unravel. But, you know, Richard Hamilton, British artist, but internationally recognised. Mm. Richard Deacon, British artist, also internationally recognised. It's murky, and I think they haven't figured it out. So
does it matter that they haven't figured it out? I mean, yes, there was a lot of public money spent on Tate Modern. It had a remit for, you know, for contemporary art and for 20th century art. Does it really matter if Tate Britain sort of nabbing a little bit of that back every now and then?
No, and I think, you know, what Tate Britain shouldn't do is lose the contemporary side of things. So Richard is very much alive, Richard Deacon is very much alive, you know. So I think they shouldn't lose that, you know, they shouldn't lose their ability to put on contemporary art, which they have, because the Turner Prize now goes off to Derry one year, and then it will come back, and then it will move off again. I think they do that at their peril. They're Tate Britain are big on the last 500 years of British art, but last 5 or 10 are pretty interesting too. So.
Ossian Ward, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We didn't get time to talk about Isaac Julian at Victoria Miro, but that's on too, and that's good, quickly.
Yeah, very good, if
there
you
we
like
are.
Your Marxism.
There we are, and who doesn't? That's all for this edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to James Schneider, Martin Plautz, David Pleasant and Ossian Ward. Today's show was produced by Ala John, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Christy Romy. Our studio manager was Sean Malervi, Christy Roma, sorry. Next up is Culture, and Rob Bound is going a little bit all Italian on us. It is Italy Week, of course, here on Monocle 24. We're back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours London time, but for everyone here at Midori House, my name's Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.